behalf of the appellant, Kenneth Swanson. There is one issue before the court today, and that is whether the possibility that a defense witness might incriminate herself amounts to manifest necessity, allowing for a declaration of a mistrial and allowing the state to subsequently retry the defendant. In our case, the trial court abused its discretion when it granted a mistrial, as there was no manifest necessity. Therefore, his retrial was barred. In our case, Mr. Swanson was charged with weapons possession charges. And the weapons were found in his girlfriend's home. So she came in and testified that the weapons were hers. At the conclusion of the substance of her testimony, but still during direct exam by defense counsel, the trial court interrupted, called defense counsel to sidebar, both counsel to sidebar, and questioned defense counsel to what extent she was aware as to the possibility that the witness may incriminate herself. Defense counsel explained to her that she did talk to the witness ahead of time, told her she had a right to an attorney, she could incriminate herself, and there may be possible charges. The court then allowed for recess, had the witness talk to another attorney who said that he advised her not to testify further because there might be some questions that would elicit incriminating evidence. So over the state's request, with the state's request, the trial court granted a mistrial. This was an abuse of discretion, as there are only two instances where manifest necessity exists. One is to cure a juror bias, and the other is if going to a verdict would actually, going to the end would actually end up in a verdict that would be inevitably reversible. Neither of those situations occurred in our case. A manifest necessity never exists when the intent is to address a witness's right to claim their privilege against self-incrimination. And in fact, in United States versus Vorn, the United States Supreme Court held almost in an identical case that very concept. In that case, prosecution put on witnesses who might incriminate themselves. They had talked to the IRS who told them you could possibly incriminate yourself. The judge wasn't happy with that result and declared a mistrial. The Supreme Court in that case said that they could not conclude that it was done in the best interest of the defendant, therefore there was no manifest necessity. And in fact, on appeal, the state has failed to explain why there was manifest necessity. The trial court's concern with respect to Ms. Moody's privilege was misplaced. First of all, a witness does not have the right to be advised of their rights before they testify. Secondly, Ms. Moody did not incriminate herself in any way in this case. In fact, while everybody danced around it, there was no indication that she had committed any crimes with respect to possession of the weapons. The trial court was particularly concerned about incriminating herself with respect to the endangering the welfare of a child. However, the witness testified that the weapons were kept in her basement, which was locked, and that one weapon was brought up to the living room when her children were asleep, and they were seized before the children awoke.
All right, what happens after the trial judge says, I'm going to have you advised by an independent counsel, and then independent counsel says, as I understand he did here, I'm advising my client not to answer any more questions. Okay. What should happen at that point?
Well, the trial court should have explored some reasonable alternatives to declaring a mistrial. One is the defense attorney for the witness actually did not go about explaining his advice to the witness in an appropriate way. One cannot just say, as he did, I told her not to answer questions that might tend to incriminate herself. The court could have said, well, she's already waived her right because she testified to this, so she can't invoke on cross-examination. But secondly, what she could have done, which this court in Bentley approved, is talk to the parties involved, try to find out what questions involved might incriminate her, and it's the incriminating responses that she has the privilege against. In the state's retrial of the...
What was the gravamen of the state's complaint in support of the motion for the mistrial?
That they had no fair opportunity to cross-examine her because she invoked a right and therefore was not available to cross-examination.
Well, there's rarely a problem the state has with putting a witness on the stand who can't remember a 3507 statement or who has amnesia.
Correct.
And can't be cross-examined. What's the problem here?
There is no problem, Your Honor. One of the concerns, as I stated, with respect to manifest necessity is there would never be an inevitable reversal of the defendant's case because the state could not adequately cross-examine her. And they could have immunized her. They could have, like I said, addressed what specific questions.
Well, our cases often say that you have a right or a party may have an opportunity to cross-examine, but
Right. There's
no right to effective cross-examination.
That's correct.
Why doesn't that apply here?
Well, it does apply here. If I understand you correctly, the state does not have a right, as the defense does, to the extent of the amount of cross-examination they could have. If their cross-examination was simply not effective.
Well, did the trial judge grant the mistrial on the basis that the state wouldn't have an opportunity to effectively cross-examine the witness because the jury had already heard her allegedly incriminate herself,
mm-hmm.
take the blame for the defendant? The state's complaint was we have to have a mistrial because we have no mechanism by which we can test her credibility.
That is correct. That's what she granted it for.
But why doesn't that fall under the rubric of you have an opportunity to cross-examine, but you have no guarantee it'll be effective, just like it applies to everyone else?
That they should have had the opportunity to cross-examine?
That she stays on the stand and she doesn't
yes.
answer their questions to the extent they direct her to an area that might incriminate her. But they still cross-examined.
That's correct, and that's what should have happened. And that was my one suggestion, that if they had discussed in more detail what questions they were going to ask to determine what she
would. The trial judge didn't ask for a proffer, and one wasn't given.
That's correct. And, in fact, at the retrial, the state asked questions that would not have incriminated her in any way, her responses to that. So the fact that the witness was allowed to simply say through her attorney, you know what, there might be some incriminating testimony here, so I'm not going to testify further, simply incorrect. And because the trial court did not explore other alternatives, as I suggested, it simply was the incorrect decision and abuse of discretion. And, in fact, the trial court tended to put on the defense a burden of bringing to her attention the fact that there might be some problem with this witness's testimony, when in fact there was no problem with the witness's testimony until the trial court interrupted and had another attorney speak with her.
Well, there's little question it would have been easier to work one's way through this as the trial judge had you some advance notice that the defense was going to call a witness who was going to proffer factual testimony that at least suggested that she may have committed the crimes for which the defendant was tried. As a former trial judge, I certainly would have appreciated a heads up on that before somebody's already testified to that
Absolutely.
Factual scenario.
And the trial judge made two separate statements. The one was it would have been preferable if I had been told, which I don't think there's a dispute to that. Their other statement was that you had an obligation to tell the court, and there is no obligation for her to do so. And in this case, she had been told by the witness that she mm-hmm. knew of all her potential problems and wanted to testify anyways.
Originally, wasn't this witness on the state's list?
That is correct.
And is there any indication that the state didn't call her because the state knew the testimony would not be favorable?
No. In fact, the prosecutor told the judge that they never even interviewed her, so they didn't know what she was going to say. And in fact, the prosecutor, if they had intended to, they would have been in a better position than the defense attorney as to know whether or not they were going to prosecute her, and they didn't bring it to the court's attention that she might possibly be incriminating herself.
You mean the police investigation didn't show any substance to what Moody evidence might be were she to be called by either side?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. And the defense attorney made that argument to the court as well, that they were actually in the better position to know whether or not they intended to prosecute her, and they made no mention of it. And the fact that they did not interview her, whereas Ms. Van Amerogen had actually talked to her and been assured by her that she wanted to go forward with this. And the only concern, really, was whether or not she'd incriminate herself with respect to endangering the welfare of a child, which she was subsequently arrested for and pled guilty to. And her testimony was to the contrary. It was, they were locked up away from my children. I only brought the one gun out while they were in bed. They were seized before they got out. So none of that was incriminating.
I take it that's because she wasn't a person prohibited.
That's correct. Any of the weapons offenses, for her possession of the weapon, there was no facts involved that would have made that illegal under the Delaware Code. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Deputy Attorney General Gregory Smith on behalf of the state. Your Honor, the Superior Court reasonably exercised its discretion in determining that manifest necessity did require a declaration of mistrial in this case. First, the situation was unfortunately created by defense counsel. Defense counsel's question, particularly at the end, the one that prompted the court's intervention regarding, are you aware of the legal consequences of your testimony, tied right into where things were going. It was an effort to bolster the credibility of that witness's testimony, which was in fact the entire defense that Mr. Swanson was putting on regarding the weapons.
Well, does it matter whose fault it was? Isn't the standard the manifest necessity standard, regardless of how circumstances got to that point?
Your Honor, I guess short answer, yes, it does matter. If the state were at fault, then...
Right, I understand. Okay. But in terms of whether there was a manifest necessity or not, is not the same thing as whose fault it is, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so what made this a situation where there was a manifest necessity for a mistrial?
The manifest necessity would be that a witness had been able to offer their entire testimony for the defendant without being subject to cross-examination by the state. That's the crux of the matter. But
are you saying that would have automatically required reversal on appeal?
No, Your Honor, the state's not requesting a per se rule on that issue. This is not an example of where one answer to a question the court could say, direct the jury to disregard that answer, and a curative instruction would be appropriate. This was the heart and soul of the defense case. It was, as defense counsel acknowledged in a discussion with Superior Court, that testimony had been previewed in an opening statement. This was not a bell that could be unrung and simply ask the jury to disregard that.
Why couldn't the state cross-examine to the extent it was able?
From the record, it does not appear that the witness was going to be willing to provide any testimony. There would not be any cross-examination that she was invoking her Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination.
And what crimes would she have been committing?
Your Honor, if I may direct the court, and this is from something that defense counsel said during the colloquy with Superior Court at page A39 of the appendix, quote, I'm telling the court all this because I do see that there are potential charges, even just keeping them in your home, unquote. And then later on A39, quote, I said, well, do you know the act of selling a firearm, even if someone didn't report it stolen? You're talking about not only bringing it out on the street, you're talking about turning around and reselling it to somebody. If that was your intent, that could also get you charged by the AG's office. She said, yes, I understand that, unquote. There are some further statements on A40. I don't mean to, I'm certainly willing to read them. I don't want to burden the court unnecessarily. If the court.
Does the record reflect what questions the state proffered it would ask?
No, Your Honor. That is not in the record at all.
Then there's an assumption that the prosecution wouldn't have been successful but for cross-examination of this witness?
Your Honor, I'm not sure we're suggesting that there should be an assumption of how the case would have played out. It's just a question of the interest of justice that is incorporated in the holding in Jorn. The interest of justice has to mean something to both the defendant and to the state.
Well, then, remember my question of your colleague. How many times have we seen cases where witnesses take the stand and don't answer questions, put the Fifth Amendment aside for a moment, and the case law says you're entitled to cross-examine, but you're not entitled to an effective cross-examination, and as long as the witness is on the stand, they're subject to cross-examination. Why doesn't that apply here?
Your Honor, the state does not disagree with that statement. The reason it's not applicable here is that there was no cross-examination. This wasn't a question of whether there would have been effective cross-examination.
Well, that's because the state didn't go forward and ask any questions. Instead, they asked for a mistrial on the theory that they couldn't effectively cross-examine because the areas on which they wished to cross-examine, the court had just ruled, were protected by the witness's Fifth Amendment privilege, correct?
Your Honor, it would appear that based on the representation that the conflict counsel, Mr. Bernstein, who was brought in, that the witness was making a blanket invocation of her Fifth Amendment privilege and did not intend to answer any questions at that time.
Well, he may have said that's how he interprets the Fifth Amendment, but the question here is, did the trial judge properly deal with it, and why would the witness be prohibited from being cross-examined on areas that did not implicate commission of a crime, such as where she was on a certain point on a certain day, or where the defendant may have been within her knowledge on a certain day, or how long they've had a relationship, or anything like that?
Your Honor, I can't say that there would not have been questions on cross-examination that would not have, that would have been okay, that would not have resulted in implication.
Give me a case that says, under these circumstances, other courts have dealt with the witnesses freezing up as a potential cross-examinee because they've invoked their Fifth Amendment rights and the remedy has been a mistrial.
Your Honor, the state cannot offer any case directly on point.
Well, any cases that discuss the concept of manifest necessity encompass these facts?
These exact facts, no, Your Honor. This is a fairly unique circumstance.
Well, if I were to write the opinion, I'd need some help in explaining how this concept of effective cross-examination as opposed to availability to be cross-examination is different here, the availability to be cross-examined, is different here than it is in the typical 3507 situation.
Your Honor, the witness, I'm sorry, I should not have just said, I mean, Mr. Bernstein did make a representation to the court. The witness, too, also represented to the court that she would not be answering questions.
Well, that's the confusing point here. This blanket invocation of the right against self-incrimination as to all questions, if we look at both briefs, the suggestion is I've told her she shouldn't answer any more questions without limitation. The trial judge appeared to say, I think that's a good idea. And then the prosecutor moved for a mistrial. Isn't the normal course to say that you take the questions one at a time and you invoke your Fifth Amendment rights with regard to a particular question? You just can't simply say, I'm not answering any more questions. I'm not participating in cross-examination.
Your Honor, that does seem to be the much more normal way.
So why would the trial judge agree with the suggestion that it would be a good idea for you not to answer any more questions?
Your Honor, my understanding of that would be based on kind of what's led up to that. I guess the representation is that Ms. Moody had been available to consult with four other attorneys. That's at A38. Then later on, defense counsel explains she in fact lists those four attorneys at A43. But then she states that Ms. Moody consulted with them on behalf of Swanson. So from the record, it does not appear that Moody, in fact, consulted with any conflict-free counsel before she got up on the stand. And from the record, it's fair to say the defense counsel was aware of that. This may very well be an entirely different case if defense counsel had not asked those last questions right before Superior Court felt the need to intervene. The questions of, do you understand that you're possibly there are possible legal consequences to your testimony?
The reason I've asked you whether the state made a proffer about the questions it would ask, I'm somewhat concerned that there's an assumption that the state would ask questions that would incriminate Ms. Moody when their whole goal was to incriminate Swanson. Wouldn't it be a bit inconsistent in their tactics to ask questions of Moody that would incriminate her?
Your Honor, the questions would not be designed to implicate her, but if her answers to those would be consistent with what she's already made regards to other facts on, other questions on direct examination, her answers to those questions would be likely to implicate her. The state's goal would not be to implicate her, but
we don't have a record that shows what those questions would have been.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And there's no representation to the trial judge that here are the questions I must ask in order to do my job, otherwise I won't be able to effectively cross-examine this witness. That leaves me with no remedy other than to start anew without the new jury having heard anything Ms. Moody said about possessing or owning the firearms and ammunition. And the trial judge just accepted that.
Yes, Your Honor. Based on, certainly the decision was not a hasty one. There cannot be any argument that this was a snap decision by Superior Court.
Sometimes snap decisions are better than ones you think about too long.
I will agree with that, Your Honor. But that is one of the issues that in the analysis that Jorn considers is whether.
Well, let's go back to manifest necessity. That just the term itself suggests that there's just no other rational alternative but to grant a mistrial. It's just absolutely obvious that it's necessary to handle it that way. That's a layman's view anyway of the terms. What, as a term of art, what does the case law teach us that term means, and how does it fit with these facts?
Opposing counsel represented are correct, but it's not two and only two. If manifest necessity would mean, if we were to go through with a trial, that the defendant, as a matter of right, would be able to have the case reversed. That's certainly an occasion, and the state's not suggesting that. That's the situation. The state's position regarding manifest necessity fundamentally comes down to the total absence of ability to cross-examine a witness.
Well, but the total absence only came about when the judge agreed it would be good not to answer any questions. And the Chief Justice and I are trying to explore why the judge didn't say, let's take it a question at a time, or tell us what your questions are. Maybe we'll have a motion in limine where we say that's not permissible because that will provoke an incriminating answer. But rather than simply say, no more questions, no more answers, why wasn't the more reasonable alternative question by question?
Your Honor, as I stand here today, that it's hard not to say that that might not be a more reasonable alternative.
Well, to what extent was peak on the part of the trial judge that the trial judge didn't know about this in advance and be given some time to think about it? What did that play, if any, in the decision to grant the mistrial? Any suggestion of that?
No, Your Honor. I believe, in fact, at A42, Superior Court of the appendix, I don't want to declare a mistrial. That was Superior Court was not hoping to declare a mistrial.
I'm sure of that. But there was some suggestion that part of the trial judge's reasoning process included the fact that defense counsel didn't bring it to the trial judge's attention beforehand. Is that wrong? Is that wrongly suggested in the briefs?
Certainly, I think it's a fair statement that Superior Court believed it would have been more appropriate for defense counsel to bring the situation to the court's attention before trial started.
Was it a consideration in coming to the conclusion that it was a manifest necessity to grant the state's request for a mistrial?
Your Honor, that's certainly not what Superior Court said is for its reason to declare the mistrial.
Okay, do you happen to have at hand the actual ruling by reference to the appendix?
I hope so.
Well, don't worry about it if you don't.
Okay,
I'm
sorry, Your Honor.
No, don't worry about it. I should have known it myself. We'll find it. Go ahead. You have, I think, 4 minutes and 20 seconds left.
Your Honor, certainly this, I would just like to emphasize one factual point. The state had rested its case. The state had not called Ms. Moody as a witness. This was a decision by defense counsel to call Ms. Moody to the stand and clearly had consulted with Ms. Moody prior to the commencement of the trial. It's something that should factor into the calculus. And
did the state know when Ms. Moody's name was called what she might testify to?
Your Honor, this would be my assumption.
Well, I always mean what does the record reflect, not what you know independently or suspect or speculate. Does the record show that the state knew as soon as her name was called that there might be a problem with her testimony, but let her testify anyway without objection?
I can't say definitively yes or no to that, Your Honor.
Is it important for us to know whether or not the state had reason to believe she would testify that the weapons and the ammunition were hers and not the defendant's, but let her go ahead and testify to that without moving to strike her testimony or objecting to her testifying at all?
Your Honor, I don't think the state could object to her testimony at all because that would prevent the defense from putting on
If the trial judge were bothered that defense counsel didn't bring to the trial judge's attention potential problems with Moody's testimony, why wasn't the trial judge equally troubled by the fact that the state had listed her as a witness? Presumably, you don't list witnesses unless you know what they're going to testify to, even if you choose not to call them. Why wasn't the trial judge equally perturbed that the state allowed her to testify when they knew she would be testifying or had reason to believe that she would be testifying, that the guns and the ammunition that were the heart and soul of this case were hers and not the defendant's? Who should have teed it up? Who should take the blame, if blame's important, for not teeing it up?
Your Honor, I think the prosecution would have considered calling Ms. Moody as a rebuttal witness. She was certainly a potential witness that way. I mean, the state, although clearly chose not to call her, it was within the calculus of, yes, this.
No, but when the defense said, our next witness is Stacy Moody, mm-hmm. anything click in the prosecutor's mind that the only thing Stacy Moody could testify to would be subject matter that might subject her to incrimination, and therefore, even if defense counsel hasn't recognized this, as an officer of the court, I'll bring it to the court's attention before this thing unravels the way it ultimately did.
Your Honor, there's nothing in the record that would allow me to
say that either way.
To say that either way.
That's fair.
I'm sorry.
That's fair.
I guess if I may leave the court with one final thought, just on the emphasis of why some cross-examination was so critical. Just to quote the much quoted phrase, the greatest legal engine ever intended for the discovery of the truth, and that being cross-examination, and the lack of that would be the basis for a manifest necessity.
Well, that dispels my notion that the greatest engine is 3507. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
First of all, Your Honor, the court's ruling is Exhibit B to the defendant's brief. The state has stated to the court, it is hard to say that there was not a more reasonable alternative. This court in Bailey v. State and the Third Circuit in United States v. Rivera state that it has to be clear from the record that there is no clear or manifest reasonable alternative. So that forecloses the argument that there was manifest necessity here. And at A40, it appears that the defense counsel told the prosecutor the day before that she would be calling the witness to testify. So they were aware the day before.
Where is that in the record?
A40. And finally, the fact that the situation may or may not have been caused by defense counsel, which we contend that it was not caused by defense counsel, in United States versus Jorn, the Supreme Court stated that blame of one party or the other does not dictate whether or not there's manifest necessity. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.
Thank you.